The Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy will come to order. Today we're going to, actually I think Commissioner Hansen is starting first, everyone, if you don't mind. We're going to have an update on the status and process here in Minnesota of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act and the interaction with Minnesota. Commissioner Hansen and State Budget Director Showalter have joined us. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and members of the LCPFP. We have some handouts for you along the lines of the questions, Madam Speaker, that you had asked last whatever
if
day it was.
If you would pull the mic closer, that would be great.
Madam Speaker, we have handouts that I would like to refer to that Mr. Showalter will hand out, and I'll refer to them. The first, I can wait till it comes around.
Sure. We can, as they're being passed out, next week we're going to find a time to meet, and we're going to focus on the, as they have been called, the shovel-ready sections of the bill and applicability to Minnesota in terms of transportation, water, and any other areas. And I'm hoping that we can certainly hear from the departments and agencies that are responsible for those, but we may also want to hear from some contractors in Minnesota who have had, and some labor folks who've had interaction with the development of the bill, the federal bill, and how they also see this affecting both the jobs on the ground and the economy. So we are going to, and continued updates for where we need further information. So, Commissioner, I think everyone has your handouts.
All right, Madam Speaker, thank you. The first, we're handing out two pieces of information. The second one, Mr. Showalter will walk through, but Senator Clark had asked for a somewhat of a timeline of stimulus and budget-related activities for the next few months. The other sheet is based on the federal funds information to states, FFIS, a list of the monies that we are that FFIS is predicting that we're going to get, and I'll refer to that here in my opening comments.
So that's the table?
That's the table. That's correct. And Madam Speaker and members, I believe FFIS has a relationship with NCSL, our state budget officers organization, and NGA, and a number of, they're the numbers analyzers for legislation and other issues related to federal funds. So what we have done is taken their latest information and put a sheet, put a table together for you. The caveat that and you'll see it, and I'm just summarizing that first paragraph, the caveat is this is FFIS reviewing the language as it passes the, Congress and signed into law, but the actual amounts may fluctuate based on whatever federal agency is interpreting their section of the bill and how that relates to our state. So there's my one caveat. These numbers may fluctuate, and we'll try to get you more precise numbers in the days ahead. The you'll see, and I won't, unless you want me to, Madam Speaker, walk through every column, but, line by line, but you'll see that we have the House bill, the Senate bill, the ARRA is what is signed into law and what we are anticipating we're going to receive at this point for the state of Minnesota. And then you had asked at the last meeting, Madam Speaker, a list by agency tied to who's primarily responsible for administering the funds.
It's very helpful, Commissioner. Are you going to, if you're going to move off this sheet, I think members might have some questions. And we also provided for the members of the commission the state-by-state spreadsheet so people can take a look at that. You
right.
Probably need some sort of magnifying glass, and they did blow up the line for Minnesota, so it's a little easier to read. But believe me, yesterday Well, we all get older, don't we?
And Madam Speaker, mine is an 11 by 17. It's a
okay.
little easier to read.
Great.
And highlighted. But since I know that your fiscal staff has that as well, I was going to offer to send that to you if you wanted. But you can see the breakdown by funds, and they even have the original House and Senate positions. You can see the areas that didn't receive funding. So it's as far as getting an overall picture of every state, what was funded, what wasn't, what were the original position, what wasn't. The second document you showed, the big spreadsheet, is pretty good.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, my understanding is that based on the estimates that we've gotten so far, that we should get about $2 billion over the next biennium in terms of increased Medicaid funding. And my understanding also is that you intend to forecast that against the budget forecast that would be coming out on March 3rd. Is that correct?
Madam Speaker, Senator Berglund, that is correct. The caveat I will place on that, the $2 billion figure for Minnesota first appeared last Thursday night from from the Government Accounting Office, put out a spreadsheet of MA numbers, and you may have seen it, and it had us at the number we have here at $2.03 billion. I have been expressing some caution in that number, depending on how CMS might interpret it. I'm told it could be as low as 1.8, so it is a range. I hope it's 2 billion, and we will count it in the forecast. And then the other issue that we, as I mentioned in the last hearing before you, we will be identifying those items that of the governor's budget that may violate maintenance of effort requirements, and we'll be offering proposals in our supplemental budget to, to amend our supplemental budget. It's going to be somewhere for certain around 89 to 90 million, and depending how CMS interprets the language, the maintenance of effort language in the bill, that could go up as high as 200. million dollars.
Well, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, I urge you to be on the conservative side, as the Department of Finance usually is.
Yes.
But the second part of my question then is, as we look over the governor's budget of about $1.4 billion in reductions in the area of health and human services, probably 90% of that is Medicaid money. And so then we lose some of that $2 billion or $1.8 or whatever it's going to be. And how do you plan on accounting for that so that we actually know what one might call our true deficit number when we are looking at it at when you forecast it on March 3rd?
Mr. Showalter?
Madam Speaker, Senator Berglund, I think there's two different pieces here. One is in the forecast, where we'll discuss as clearly as we possibly can what the economic impact is on our revenues and spending.
Mr. Showalter, if you could move the mic closer. It is a little noisy in here.
Very good.
I'm not quite sure. Maybe there's a lot of side conversations as well. It's like the House floor right now.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
In the forecast, we will try to identify any assumptions related to the stimulus as clearly as possible so you have an understanding of what FMAP changes or if there's anything else that seems to be relevant to current law forecast. Moving on to the governor's budget, which will follow that point at some point in time, we're going to have to reprice all of the governor's requests or recommendations based upon this new forecast. And as you suggest, if we are receiving more than 50% in matching funds from the federal government, any cuts to our medical assistance program will be worth less because we will not be paying for the other 50%. We'll be paying for 40% or some other percentage.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Showalter, that's one part of the problem. The budget pages are worth less.
Yes.
Some of them, I suppose, will be adjusted somewhat by the lower numbers of people losing their eligibility. But the other side of the problem is that you've already counted $2 billion or $1.8 billion, whatever it is you're going to count, as being subtracted against the deficit. So now as you do these budget pages, yes, they're worth less because you don't have to spend as much to get a Medicaid dollar, but you also need to be taking something off of the $1.8 or $2 billion that we will be losing as we reduce our Medicaid spending. And I don't understand how the budget process will work to account for that.
Mr. Showalter, do you?
Madam Speaker,
Commissioner?
Senator Berglund, you're I think, talking about the $920 million plug that we have in the original governor's budget for an estimated stimulus amount.
Commissioner, I don't think that's what she's talking about. Mr. Showalter, I'll give you a shot at it, and then maybe we need some clarification.
Okay. Madam Speaker, Senator Berglund, you're absolutely right. There's going to be a number of moving pieces, as there usually is with a forecast, and recalibrating the governor's budget. In this case, we get an extra dose of uncertainty because of this economic stimulus package. Essentially, the process is going to be starting from the current law forecast, defining the new deficit figure, and then looking at the repriced governor's proposals, and then we're going to have to assess where we're at. After you see the new impact of those proposals, under some definition of which ones are allowable, which ones are not, and then we're going to have to strike a new bottom line. As the commissioner was saying, the initial budget recommended or assumed $920 million in stimulus funds. If that figure goes up, that would be to the good in the governor's budget, but then, of course, there's going to be, as we're talking about, things that are going to fall away, savings that are going to fall away because of changes of FFP, changes because of some proposals may have to be pulled back. What the net of that is, I think, will be the work of the next few weeks.
Senator Berglund.
I'm going to ask this question a little differently, and I hope this time I get through. So when will we know exactly what the budget deficit is? Obviously, we won't know on March 3rd because you're subtracting whatever you think the FMAP dollars will be. But then as we look at the governor's budget, we will see a reduction in that number because we're reducing our matching funds. So when will we know exactly what the budget deficit is that we need to be trying to backfill in order to balance the budget?
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Speaker, Senator Berglund, we'll know the current law deficit on March 3rd. We'll have an estimate of that. You're asking, I think, when will we know what the governor's recommendations are on how to address that, because you're trying to sort of, what's the re-estimate of the governor's figures?
Senator,
and I'm sorry for the
Senator
miscommunication.
But Senator Berglund, are you talking about one thing here is maybe are you talking about your budget area specifically or the overall?
Overall.
Okay, so
this is Madam Chair or Madam Speaker, this is a very important question for every area of the budget. Because $2 billion is a lot of money to be subtracting from a budget deficit. And, of course, it is one-time money. We do know that.
Yep.
But be that as it may, we probably need some one-time money to bridge us to get us where we need to be in terms of balancing the budget. But the question is, if we're basing the deficit on current law and federal funding that's going to be subtracted from the total deficit, when will we know how much of that $2 billion we shouldn't be counting on because of the governor's recommendations to reduce Medicaid spending overall, which will in turn reduce the increased FMAP dollars that we would otherwise be receiving?
Madam Speaker, Senator Berglund, the governor's recommendations are just that. They're recommendations, it's not law. If they were to go forward, I'm trying to understand what you're getting at. As Jim said, or as Mr. Showalter said, the current law forecast will come out with the $2 billion or $1.8, whatever the number is, on March 3rd. We will have a few, we have then till July 1st to enact a package that will not endanger the receipt of the federal matching funds. So,
Madam Speaker, there is no way that you cut $1.4 billion out of the Health and Human Services budget and not lose a significant amount of that $2 billion. And we know the governor didn't balance the budget in the next biennium. The question is, how much will it not be balanced this biennium? And this is a pretty important question for me to know, because if we're not balanced this biennium leaving this session, we know what the governor will do. He will unallot. And I have a pretty good idea whose budget he'll look at first to do an allotment from. So I'm just asking for you to be fair and honest with us and upfront with us so we know where we're at when we leave the session.
Madam Speaker, Senator Berglund, we will be fair, honest, clear, and transparent. As far as unallotting in this biennium, from the information we're receiving right now from the federal government, we should be getting some of this $2 billion in the current biennium. I don't anticipate that we are going to have to unallot, or I hope we don't have to. And if we do get to that point, we're going to utilize the process we did in December. And I know we didn't all agree exactly what was on there, but we had a fairly communicative process. But I can guarantee you it's going to be clear, fair, and open.
Madam Speaker,
Berglund.
I'm not talking about this biennium, the rest of this biennium. I'm talking about when we leave here at the end of May for the next biennium, the budget that we're supposed to be balancing. And how much will it not be balanced if we are counting on all of the $2 billion, you know, coming in over the time frame that the federal government has increased the FMAP dollars?
Madam Speaker, Senator Berglund, we should know, we need to know fairly quickly for our budget submission to you, as well as for you putting your budget together, what is allowable and what isn't under the maintenance of effort requirements from CMS.
Maybe we can go
back. Supposed to know that.
Maybe we can get
back. Does anybody else understand the question?
So
am I not
Senator
asking
Olson,
it clearly?
Senator Olson seems to want to help. I do have other people on the list, but I'm going to Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, would it be incorrect to assume that when you know what monies are coming and what is what's tied to them, that the governor may, in fact, go back to square one in some areas and rethink? I mean, should we be thinking about his current budget, or will we see a different picture based on what monies are available for what categories and where he might want to be making the cuts? Or would we, because I think that's what she's getting at, will we still be in the same, using those same monies, not taking into account that some of the monies that you're counting as income would not be available? I mean, it would seem to me that in your amended budget process, you would be taking into consideration how many of these federal dollars you would want to be qualified to meet by the proposal that is set forward.
So,
is that inaccurate?
Well,
Commissioner,
let me answer it this way, and I'm trying to understand. Madam Speaker, Senator Olson, in the case of Human Services, the governor's recommendations on January 27th had a $1.4 billion reduction in human services spending proposed for 2010 and 2011. Right now, based on the information that we have received from Washington, up to $200 million of the governor's recommendations may violate the maintenance of effort requirements.
Okay.
So we set those aside. You know, the most likely set those aside. So instead of $1.4 billion of reductions, you have $1.2 and of course, you have to consider what Mr. Showalter said, repricing the governor's budget based on the new forecast, based on the different formula of the federal money versus the state. So, but 1.4, if it's 200, 1.2, and then I'm assuming then that would meet our maintenance of effort requirement, and we accept the $2 billion in the forecast, and then we work with you the rest of the session to determine what that package actually looks like. But I'm assuming in the end we're going to have a budget coming out of that we're all going to agree to that is not going to violate maintenance of effort requirements that would jeopardize us getting federal funds.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Speaker and Commissioner, but would it be fair to say that we could agree that whether it's your budget or our budget or anybody's budget, that if we're going to balance the budget, we'll be cutting Medicaid spending somehow?
Commissioner.
Madam Speaker, Senator Berglund, I don't know if I agree with you. We have to consider very carefully. I can't foresee a scenario where we would cut and jeopardize $2 billion in federal funds.
Senator.
Madam Speaker and Commissioner, I'm not talking about areas that would jeopardize the maintenance of effort, but for instance, cutting a service like dental care or cutting rates or any of a number of the, you know, myriad of 185 change pages would still be potentially on the table. And when you take those pages into account, you have now lost some of the $2 billion that otherwise would be coming to the state. You only get that money if you're doing current level of spending on Medicaid. Because you have to pay a dollar to get a dollar plus.
So, Commissioner, I think Budget Director, I think it really boils down to the question of how you maximize the federal dollars and at what point will committee chairs know. I mean, basically, we're really talking about a do-over budget for the governor at this point because of how many moving parts there are in this. And although there was a budget proposal, it has changed substantially by what's just happened. So at what point do people like Senator Berglund know the recommendation of the governor and then the interaction with the federal dollars and the continued deficit that we may face, the cuts that need to be made in individual areas in the budget? I think that's
the crux of the, Madam Speaker, the whole. I think you summarized it very well. And I don't know if the whole budget's a do-over. Human services most likely will be.
Which, of course, is 35% of the budget.
Right.
And education has a do-over, and that's 45% of the budget.
Of it.
All right. So we're kind of the whole thing. It's okay. We'll grant you the do-over.
We're precise at fine.
We'll get back to this. Representative Solberg.
But just one final thing, Senator Berglund, I hope we continue to talk to make sure that we are our goal is the minute we understand and get these issues, either myself or Commissioner Ludeman will be in touch with you and your House counterpart to try and understand this.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Speaker, I understand that the details, Commissioner, will come via people who work in the Department of Human Services. But the crux of my question is not a question for them. It's a question for you. Because you will have to adjust the $2 billion that you're going to forecast, that you're going to subtract from the deficit. You're going to have to adjust that number downward. And that's your job. And I just want to know how much that's going to be and then how much of the deficit we have that the stimulus money in terms of Medicaid doesn't erase.
I think we have, Madam Speaker, I think we must have a different understanding of this, Senator Berglund, of what this maintenance of effort is going to be. And maybe with, I understand that if it's a $200 million subtraction, we still receive the $200 million. We will have to reprice it based on some of the governor's proposals, but I'm assuming most or all of the governor's proposals that we have proposed, absent the MOE subtraction, are going to still go forward. And we still get the $2 billion.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Speaker and Commissioner, we only get it if we maintain the spending level we have today. This doesn't have to do with maintenance of effort. I'm assuming you'll take care of that in your budget. And if you haven't, we'll let you know that we have a disagreement about that. But you have to be doing the $2 billion is based on current level of Medicaid spending. You have to spend a dollar to get a federal dollar. And if we're reducing the dollar we're spending, we're reducing the federal money we get in. And if you're subtracting that from the federal from the state deficit, you have to at some point admit that. And you have to then say, and the deficit's increasing by this much, that we have to backfill some other way.
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Speaker, Senator Berglund, certainly we can continue and need to continue this conversation over the days to come. But one thing that I've heard us talking slightly different terms is what the maintenance of effort requirements are in the stimulus bill. And that's certainly a knowable proposition. Our understanding is that it's maintenance of effort on eligibility as of a date certain, not necessarily a dollar amount as the senator was just discussing. And we should make sure that we're both talking in the same terms, because eligibility doesn't necessarily determine how much. It's one of the factors in total spending, but rates, other things like that are going to be also factors into what over the overall state budget numbers for medical assistance would be. So I think that might be part of what we want to clarify. The other part, if I could just clarify, is that the forecast sets the initial DHS budget estimate based upon current law. That will be repriced. It'll be repriced based upon new federal matching funds rates. The value of the governor's recommendations may change. The value of the stimulus doesn't change. It's the value of his changes may change because they may either violate the stimulus package, MOE, or it may be because the matching rate has changed to some extent. So those are the two elements I'd just like to try and clarify if I could.
That's why we're going to keep meeting like this. And I don't want to spend our whole time on this because we do have other guests today, but Representative Solberg.
Madam Speaker, just one quick question on your chart that you have here. Your second one down under the ARRA is the fiscal stability of the general purposes. I think that's one that gives us a little bit of flexibility in helping to solve the budget. Do you know yet how much of that would be available in 09, or is it and is it spread out over 3 years, or is it just for the next biennium?
Mr. Showalter?
Madam Speaker, Representative Solberg, I am not sure how much of that is available in 09. I know the two bodies had differing interpretations, and I'm not sure what the final language allows. We can certainly get back to you on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Speaker,
that
I think that's very
helpful
to know.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Commissioner, I just want to make sure that I'm appreciating the sort of the one-time nature of most of these monies, at least as I understand them. When we get the forecast on March 3rd, I understand from the dialogue that was just had with Senator Berglund that we'll see the impact of the federal stimulus on the current biennium. I trust that the forecast will also, as it's done in the past, deal with the next biennium and sort of the cliff that's created by this one-time money. Am I understanding that correctly?
Commissioner.
Yes. Yeah, Madam Speaker, Representative Coles, yes, you are.
So, Madam Speaker and Commissioner, is it a fair statement then to say that by building the stimulus money into the budget that we are looking at a more significant deficit in the out years?
Commissioner.
Madam Speaker, Representative Coles, yes. If you look at if your baseline is the governor's budget, much of the progress the governor's budget makes in the tails 12 and 13 is human services reductions from 10 and 11 that are carried forward. So the extent to which you undo recommendations in 10 and 11 and supplant them with one-time money, you're not going to have those savings in 12 and 13. And your structural deficit goes up unless you make other arrangements.
And Madam Speaker, Commissioner, I appreciate your commitment to Senator Berglund that yourself or Commissioner Ludeman or others will be in contact with regard to information as it becomes known. I hope that the same courtesy will be extended to the Republican leadership in the House and to Senator Senjum and his leadership team in the Senate, so that while the governor may be preparing his do-over budget, the legislature bipartisanly has an opportunity to do a budget. We're not at the do-over stage yet. We're still at the do stage. And I look forward to the dialogue between the legislature and the executive branch with our competing budget proposals. And I'm quite certain that the House and Senate won't line up perfectly without some conference committee action. But I think that it's important that we in the legislature remember our responsibility and obligation to actually enact a budget that's balanced in the current biennium and take into account the strings attached with this federal money and recognize the implications, the long-term structural implications of doing that in the out biennium.
Representative Coles, you raise a good point, and it's a point that I think is going to be highlighted by the next set of guests in terms of structural balance of our situation in this state and what happens into the future. Commissioner, if you could go over the other pieces of information that you have brought for us today, and then I have a couple questions for you that then can be followed up upon next week.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I don't know. We didn't hand this up, did we? We have handed out, Madam Speaker and members, you asked for a list of federal stimulus coordinators by state agencies. We have made that available to you.
And, Commissioner, are you meeting with this group of people? Is it sort of like a cabinet, or is it just as a as-need basis, or are you doing something to actually coordinate this group of people?
Madam Speaker, members, we are have convened a sub-cabinet of the half dozen or so major agencies with the biggest issues. We had our first meeting on Tuesday and are going to meet weekly. We communicate on a daily basis by phone call and email with this group as well.
Could you just identify, Commissioner, the subgroup that you're meeting with?
It's admin? The Department of Administration, Madam Speaker.
Yes.
Commerce. Sorry, not commerce. Deed.
Oh, I'm sorry, no, not commerce.
They were there. Yeah, commerce.
Okay, so.
It is, sorry, I didn't bring that list. It's the Department of Administration, Department of Commerce, Deed, Education, Housing Finance will be there.
Okay.
Housing. Human Services, Management and Budget, and Transportation.
Could you send the constituents over here?
And that was more just kind of the bigger issues, and we may end up pulling others in, but you get more than six or seven commissioners in a room, and it's
helpful information.
Then, Madam Speaker, I'm having ongoing calls with the staff of our congressional delegation, and we'll offer, as I have, if you want to have staff or a few people sit in to comment. It's going to be next Tuesday to give them an update. I want to.
Commissioner, thank you for that offer. I do think that as much as possible, where the administration and the executive and legislative branch can work together on this, it helps with a basic level of understanding of what's happening with these dollars and what's permissible and not. And, with a March 3rd forecast and a significantly redone budget, we are going to have to really sprint to the end here to make a May 18th adjournment date. And so I think, maybe you can discuss this among your team, but if there is a way to at least include representation from the four caucuses in some of these discussions, even with the subgroup, I think that is going to help. Or research departments, the nonpartisan research and fiscal staff, that is going to help us all in understanding and having a level playing ground here in terms of putting together this budget. Because Representative Coles is right, as much as we can, the effort all together to assemble the final budget.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea, and I will follow up. Before, go ahead.
And then you had another handout that.
Another handout. Mr. Showalter will walk through our stimulus activities.
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Speaker, committee members, I don't want to oversell this next document, but the request was for a rough understanding of what's happening in the next few weeks, if not months. So I try to take especially from the broad view, what some of the things that we expect to happen and when they are expected to happen.
Okay.
I should just note for the audience in particular, things change all the time. As we all know, we get new information on a daily basis. And
hourly basis, Mr. Showalter,
exactly.
From my experience.
And so this is to be taken with a grain of salt. That being said, in February, we're looking at a number of different activities. The most important is just understanding what is in these stimulus provisions, understanding what's happening with the stabilization funding, what are the requirements, what are the possibilities, understanding the FMAP provisions, understanding those maintenance of effort requirements, those kinds of issues.
And Mr. Showalter, I guess it would be helpful if maybe together a group of people could identify the most trusted sources of information on this for fiscal staff and nonpartisan staff as well as other staff to be able to understand where we should be going, because someone was able to get me the NGA document, but that's different than maybe the NCSL document. You know, where should we be going? So maybe we could work on that here together.
Very good. Madam Speaker, members, just continuing on, you'll see some other items. I don't think I'll try to, unless you'd like me to, I can read through these. But
maybe if members have specific questions on the timeline that's been presented. Senator Frederickson?
Madam Chair, Ms. Schroeder. In March, the first bullet there, compile and circulate information on federal fund requests. Is there going to be a separate entity and administration that looks at all those requests and then distributes them out to the appropriate agency, or will it be coming through regular agency staff? You know, I'm getting requests now from my district, you know, of possible projects that would be shovel ready, for example, in 120 days. How do I make sure they connect with the right people so that they get considered?
Mr. Showalter.
Madam Speaker, Senator, great question. Let me just give you a couple pieces of background. One is this list of contacts is, I think, one of our first steps to make sure that the myriad of questions that come through from the public, through legislative offices, calls into our office, start to get closer to the right person, so that each agency has at least that point person to get that specific request, in this instance a shovel-ready project, to the right department. Two, as the commissioner indicated at the previous meeting, these projects, these authorizations will require, at a minimum, legislative review. In some instances, legislative approval, appropriations. And so those are the kinds of things that are going to have to come to the legislature, either in bill form, in federal funds requests form, as elements of the governor's budget. One way or another, we're going to have to find ways to communicate all of these projects and all of the items to you. And that's what I'm trying to get to here, is what's the format of that, what's the information, so that all of those requests are known and clearly available to the legislature and the public generally.
Mr. Showalter and Commissioner, to follow up on Senator Frederickson's question, I know a couple of states have established on the front end someone who is just doing work on the idea of a shovel-ready project and screening those. Is there someone doing that in the administration?
Madam Speaker, there isn't one individual. We've so far organized around each agency knowing their programs, knowing what is shovel-ready, trying to triage those programs within their own priority setting. We'll be hearing about those. We'll be discussing those with them, as with you, in the coming weeks.
Madam
Senator
Speaker,
Frederickson,
just to follow up on that question, and I think our dialogue beforehand was the next meeting you want to have a little more discussion on that process. The Department of Transportation has a process. They had a stakeholder meeting that 400 people showed up at on Friday the deputy commissioner ran. So there's that big piece. The PFA has the standard list that we're all familiar with of drinking water and clean water projects that cities and municipalities submit their list, and they get rated and put on the list, and then every biennium we fund some of the projects on the list and some we don't. So right now, most of these federal funds are being that we're receiving are being plugged into existing programs that have existing lists, and we're trying to funnel the new requests in through that.
But, Commissioner, there is a basket of money here that is going to be competitive grant money.
Yes.
That is competitive grant money for both states, local units, and individual projects that are coming through. Everything from health information, broadband, green jobs, and maybe that's a little more. Senator Frederickson, would you like to follow up on that? I mean, that's kind of the sorts of things that we're starting to get questions about from constituents and constituency groups, and not quite sure where to send them. So the process around that process of competitive grant processes as well, maybe others too.
And Madam Chair, you're right. I was looking for that kind of direction, but also for existing programs, we just need to know how to direct the request to the right person. And I think that's something, as I hear, that they're working on
Maybe next week we'll have a little more
just
detail.
Just some insight. We have, we'll bring Madam Speaker, Senator Frederickson and members, is a list with the competitive grants we are going to assign agencies who have that area of expertise who then are going to coordinate the effort with the public and interested parties. For example, the Department of Health on information technology. The Department of Health has some experience in administering grants. They also have experience with information technology and have the ability to interact and get out with municipalities and any consortium. So what we will do on what I think it's next Tuesday or Wednesday, we can talk a little more, but the competitive grant, we have a process we have started to put together, and we'll be prepared to talk to you about it more detail with some handouts on Tuesday.
I think we are going to be back with you, and I think there are some additional questions about funds available in program dollars that are currently expended and when we're going to know how many federal dollars are available and if we meet requirements. There's issues about the Department of Education, Commissioner, you had commented that you were going to meet with them this week, and maybe you've done that now. I have since seen from Chair Miller's office a list of school district by school district IDEA funds and special ed funds that are going to come and flow directly through to school districts. Okay. Do you know more briefly that you can tell us about the education funding piece of this?
Madam Speaker, my education department meeting got moved from this morning at 11 o'clock to time to be named in the next day or so. So
okay.
I thought I would have more detail for you at this time, but I do not.
I just, one note before we ask our guests to come up and talk about the budget study trends commission. I think that one question about dividing all this up subject by subject area, which makes sense for some things, is I would like to hear about your transparency and accountability measures. And frankly, one of the things that we're not going to get to today, but the Office of Legislative Auditor has the report on internal control over statewide financial reporting. And I think that's of great concern right now to legislators that these dollars will have sufficient transparency, accountability, and audit control function over them. And I think we want to learn more about that next week as well. And, I did notice in the federal legislation with the Inspector General, there is a lot of data collection that needs to happen. I know members of the House and Senate have bills for that process to begin at the state level as well with a web-based system. I'm hoping that maybe you can tell us next week if we can access some dollars to at least begin on this project, that sort of system, to increase accountability and transparency for the public around beginning with the Federal Reinvestment and Recovery Act.
Okay,
Commissioner?
That's excellent. Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay.
We can come in and talk about that and the competitive grants. Those are two big pieces of the stimulus bill that I guess up to this point have been touched on publicly, but I think having a good discussion on that will help us all understand it a little more.
So we'll be back together again. Thank you. We'll get you a list
Thank
of
you.
Questions if there are additional things that members want to follow up on.
Thank you.
Members, I thought it would be helpful if this group would hear from the four former finance commissioners who have joined us here today, who all served on the Budget Trend Study Commission. And they are going to present to you their findings and maybe help us with looking forward how we can best use this information. So if you'd like to all identify yourself for the record, and then Mr. Kudrowski, are you going to lead the discussion?
I will, Madam Speaker, because I served the longest to go, and I think I'm the oldest. I'm Jay Kudrowski. I served as Commissioner of Finance in Governor Perpich's administration.
Actually, I think I'm the oldest, but I'm John Gunyu. I served for Governor Arne Carlson.
I'm Peggy Ingeson. I served, do I have to say how old I am?
No.
I served under as Commissioner of Finance under Governor Pawlenty.
Pam Wheelock, Commissioner of Finance under Governor Ventura.
wonderful to have all four of you, and thank you for your service on this commission. I read the report fully last night. I had read the summary previously and found it very interesting. So, Mr. Kudrowski, if you'd start us off.
Madam Speaker and members, there's a one-sheet handout that I have for you. I think just about everybody, as I look around the table, has already heard the commission's report through either the Tax or Finance Appropriations Committees. The one page has on it the 18 recommendations of the commission. And what I did was to highlight a couple of the what I consider to be the more important recommendations as it relates to what's going on right now with the governor's budget proposal and your deliberations. Let me back up for just a second and remind you that there were 15 members on the commission. It was a tripartisan commission in that the House appointed five members, the Senate appointed five members, and the governor appointed five members. It was tripartisan also in that there were Republicans, Democrats, and Independents that served on the commission. As you can tell here, we've got one Democratic administration, two Republican administrations, and one Independent administration represented in the commissioners. We also had three former legislators on this commission, some of which did mumble a few times about what they had done during their tenure. Each of us has served through a crisis. So what you're facing today is not unlike what I faced in the early 80s, that John faced in the early 90s, that Pam faced and Peggy faced in the 01-02 period. And then obviously we have the problem today. The three recommendations that I highlighted of the commission, they all are important. But to recommend a $1.5 billion budget reserve today when you don't have any dollars, I think, is less important to talk about. What is very important, I think, though, to talk about is recommendation five, which stated is to help the governor and the legislature manage long-term obligations. The state should begin by spending no more in the current biennial budget than can be supported by ongoing revenues. This is a key principle that any finance commissioner would recommend to you. It's the one that we always tried very hard to approach in our budget recommendations. To be fiscally responsible, you don't want to spend more than you have coming in. There clearly were circumstances where that couldn't be done in a particular biennium, but by the following biennium, you clearly wanted to be back into balance. So the eighth recommendation, and all of these recommendations, frankly, were adopted at the commission without controversy. There was one that I'm not going to mention that did have a minority report on. The eighth recommendation is that the governor and the legislature should create a structurally balanced budget for the current and following biennium. We've seen the governor's recommendation that I would argue is not structurally balanced. I believe, and I'm speaking for myself now rather than the commission, that the trouble that we're in today is in large part caused by the 1999 and 2001 legislative sessions, in which we thought we had more money than we did, and clearly had more money than we would on average have. And as a result, the commission or the legislature and the governor chose to both reduce taxes and increase spending in that time period that really set it up so that today what we're facing is not only a cyclical problem being caused by a very severe recession, but we also have a structural problem where I don't believe if this was a normal year that we would have sufficient revenues to pay for enacted expenditures. And then the final recommendation is the recommendation nine. When making budgetary decisions to achieve a balance of expenditures and revenues, the governor and the legislature should consider the impact of shifting the expenditure burden to the private sector or to local units of government. We had a clear understanding as we discussed this that the easiest thing for the governor and the legislature to do is, frankly, to shift the problem to somebody else. Classically, cutting school aids, local government aids, property tax relief that impacts other levels of government, and enacting policies that, in fact, is simply shifting the burden to the private sector. If you look at the back of the page, you'll see the governor's recommendation from the slides that he presented the day of the release of the budget. I've altered this particular page, not in the projected gap or in the $2,536 billion of the governor's recommendation for the biennium in 12 and 13. But what I did want to illustrate is that of the governor's recommendations, $3.2 billion of them are one-time only, which frankly doesn't lend itself to a structurally balanced budget. And omitted in the governor's recommendation was any notion of inflation in the fiscal year 12-13 biennial budget, with a reasonable assumption of $1 billion of inflation, meaning that there would be salary increases, that there would be increases in payments in various state programs in that fiscal year 12 and 13 period, that in fact you see that the governor's recommendation is unbalanced to the extent of $3.5 billion in the fiscal 12-13 time period. This is highly inconsistent with the recommendations of the commission. And given that we were staffed by the Department of Finance, well, we hope that they made recommendations for a balanced budget to the governor, but the governor's proposal didn't have either enough ongoing adjustments in fiscal years 10 and 11, nor did he solve really the problem in fiscal years 12 and 13. As has been the pattern, this was also the case in 2002, that the legislature adjourned without sufficiently addressing the deficit that was going to occur in the following biennium. And in fact, when the legislature came back into session in 2003 with then new Governor Plenty, the state found itself with a $4.5 billion deficit, some of which was because the work hadn't been done in the prior legislative session. One fears that the governor and the legislature, in trying to patch together something for this biennium, will ignore what will have to be done after the next election in that 2012 and 2013 time period. It gets to be just way too convenient to do something before the election when, in fact, it should be done before the election to solve the problem for the future. With that, Madam Chairman, you had a second question that you asked each of us to respond to. I could either take questions on the commission report, and my fellow commissioners could, or I could go on to the second question.
Why don't we go through the first observations that you have for us out of the report that you want us each to really think about here. But I wanted to just go back to one thing. On number nine, language is a funny thing. And when you say should consider the impact of shifting the expenditure, I take it that that is a the consider is not a positive reference. It's a, or maybe it is, but
well,
I
it's
think.
It's the impact, Madam Speaker, it's the impact of changing expenditures that were currently at the state level and moving them to either local government or,
yes,
say, in the case
I
of.
I get that part, but it's the use of the word consider that is a little tricky in this sentence.
Madam Chair, if I could, I think your instincts are exactly
okay.
Right. We're asking
Ms.
when
Wheelock.
You make those decisions to be aware of and transparent with respect to the impact being shifted simply to either other local units of government or individuals.
Very good, because consideration around here, just for clarity, is often a positive connotation to something, not necessarily the sort of stop,
warning, you may go off a cliff warning idea. So just wanted to clarify that in the language. Mr. Gagneau, what should we take away from your report?
Well, Madam Speaker, I think actually I was thinking about the questions of the report and also kind of life's lessons in the same context. I was question about what would we have done differently back then, and a lot of details, obviously, but I think fundamentally I'm not sure we would have done anything all that differently, and it has to do with, I think, the most important part of the study commission recommendations in my mind, which is this long-term balance that Jay talked about. And the reason, in fact, I remember back in our day, the mantra of no tails was kind of the lexicon that reverberated around, and I think that was something that my boss at the time felt very strongly about. And we used to refer to it as his Tara speech, as in Gone with the Wind, as God is my witness, I won't live through another deficit like this again. And felt very strongly about bringing that together. And I think that was shared by the legislative leadership. And so it wasn't just coming out of the corner office of this building. And I think that was a very marked difference in today and back then. And just to kind of expand on that a little, it's not a question of priorities. I mean, we're all for quality education. We're all for good job creation. It's really about balancing the budget for the long term and being fiscally responsible and then making priority choices within that. And the one recommendation out of this that I think is most important is that fundamental principle that you can't use one-time money for ongoing obligations. If anything comes out of my message, it's don't use one-time money for ongoing obligations. So whether we're talking about the federal stimulus package, which is one-time money, or whether it's something truly loony, like the plan to use debt service, to borrow to pay for debt service. I mean, that's in the current plan before you, which I can't believe the business community is not sitting at this table condemning that, because that is just a terrible idea. It's like, let me take a minute, it's like taking out a second mortgage to make a couple of your monthly payments on your first mortgage. It's worse than putting off the problem. It's leaving yourself worse off in the next year, not just delaying the problem, but that's an aside. Back to this idea of one-time money, you're going to have to use one-time money. That's in anything, any situation like this, you have to use one-time money, but it needs to be used responsibly, and what that means is using it to buy time for reform. You don't use one-time money just to continue business as usual. Use it to buy time for new revenues to phase in, for spending cuts to phase in, and that really means reform, not just cutting budgets. Cutting budgets is easy. I mean, we've made our living cutting budgets. I mean, that's the easy part, but it's trying to get the reform through so that the next biennium that Jay was talking about, it's closer to balance. I mean, we're $3.5 billion out of balance, and that's sort of the worst of all worlds. So it's all the pain of the current budget and none of the gain. So it's living through the pain of today and then having the same pain 2 years from now because there's still that problem on the table.
Ms. Ingeson.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for inviting us to come. And I just wanted to make a couple of observations about, in particular, the question that that you asked us to address is, are there particular findings of the commission that are more relevant or surprising? And one of the things, as I went back and reviewed them, I think some of us who've kind of been involved in this business for a lot of years, and I know that includes a lot of members on this commission, have seen this, the findings here year after year, whether we were talking about the Brandel Weber report or the Within Our Means report. We know that there are underlying demographic things that are going to have a dramatic effect and continue to have a dramatic effect on the economy, on the state budget, on our revenues, on our spending. We have, I think, what happens sometimes is some business cycle and some cyclical things that maybe throw that off a little bit, but underlying, I think, the things that we talked about as findings as part of this report are all things that we've been talking about for a number of years now. And I think that I was just, you know, listening to what both and John and Jay said, and I think that there are combinations of cycles. We do have some business cycle kinds of things, some economic activity that is nationwide, and then it seems like when that gets combined with some other individual or more specific actions that the legislature takes, it's particularly unfortunate. And I would say that, you know, Jay made some particular reference to more recent times, but, you know, when I worked in the Department of Finance, we did some work that looked at kind of a...
Oh, my goodness. Okay, everything okay? Was it the outlet?
Yes, it was.
Okay, well, why don't we recess here for a second?
Did it explode?
Yeah. You know, the IBEW is in the building today, so I'm pretty sure that if we needed help, we could find it quickly.
Oh.
I felt that.
She went to plug something in?
I don't know if they plugged something with a flash.
What is it?
I didn't see it.
I'm not touching. The charger blew up. I don't know.
It's okay. All right. We are going to continue.
Okay.
Courageously,
yes.
Don't touch the mics.
Don't. Yeah, stay away from the mics, everyone, and don't plug anything in the room. That would be the...
Okay. Madam Chair, I was just thinking a little bit about what we see kind of happening as cycles, and sometimes it's a combination of action the legislature takes along with some broader nationwide or worldwide economic activities that affect things. And I think we had in the late 70s, we doubled the homestead credit and indexed income taxes. Then when we looked at the problems that we had in 81, 82 with numerous special sessions, so it was both kind of that when we do some more dramatic kinds of things in our budget decisions along with some broader economic activity that really hits us with difficult problems. And I think that those things continue on in cycles. And I think the main point to make here is that we have to keep our focus on the long term. And in particular, I think it makes it very challenging for us to be thinking about the federal stimulus money. While it is certainly very welcome, I know some of the things that we're doing at our district, and in spite of maybe other portions of the budget, when we shift education funding, we see it as a real live cut. And so I think that in particular, trying to get folks to think about the things that we need to do in the long term, to think about what we need to do to restructure, to remake, to live within our means as we look 2 or 3 or 5 years out, the difficulty is that the stimulus money is kind of propping us up for a while, just knowing that it becomes a bigger cliff and a longer drop-off in a couple of years. And so, as John was saying, we really need to be thinking about the reform that needs to happen and not let the stimulus money let us continue business as usual, because we all know that there are parts of the budget and particular expenditures, whether it be in the Health and Human Services area, that are, you know, just sort of eating everything else up and impacting every area of government and spending. So I think that the big call here is, what are we going to do to restructure and reform? Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wheelock, and hopefully we'll get through your testimony without an exploding outlet in the back. It was electric, though, I have to say, Ms. Ingerson, just as you always were when you appeared before committees.
Commissioner Ingerson has always been such a nice person. I told her I probably would have talked right through it. So,
first, it was when I saw the light flash is when I knew we had to stop back there. That was...
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to just share some observations because I think as all of you, many of whom have been here much longer than I've been working either in this Capitol or in the public sector even, this is not rocket science to you. You've seen many of these recommendations before. And the reality is that these are really difficult to embrace and make progress on in a period like this. And I think that when I think about, as you look at these and as you reflect on what you do with these recommendations and how they become real to you, the real challenge is to think about what we did not do, which is to think about how you reform your process and make your decisions within this building. And I think that's the real challenge. And it is very difficult to talk about building a budget reserve, being really disciplined about the use of one-time revenues when you're facing a crisis, when you're talking about reducing people from healthcare programs or not adequately meeting the needs in either K-12 education or higher education. So I think it is very imprudent for you to think about how you are going to integrate these recommendations and the meaning and the substance behind them across biennia, across legislative sessions and across business cycles. One of the things that I learned fairly painfully during my 4 years is, unlike my learned colleague and my former boss down at the end, I actually don't believe that the problems we're experiencing today were from the 99 or the 2001 sessions. In those sessions, structurally balanced budgets were presented and actually adopted. And while at the end of the session we were starting to receive some information about receipts that the economy was starting to weaken, it wasn't until 9/11 that really became inevitable and much deeper. And at the end of that special session, the legislature adopted budget that actually increased the reserves as a result of that. The challenge, I think, was in the 2002 legislative session. And putting politics aside for a moment, the challenge was that we had built those capacities, built those reserves. We had cash flow account, budget reserve, $1 billion in tobacco endowments, some shift opportunities that were available. And what we did collectively is we adopted budgets that really didn't do anything to solve the problem, but just got us through to the next legislative session when the gubernatorial elections would be over with, the outcomes would be known, and whoever sat in the governor's office would have the first crack at developing a proposal about how to deal with it. We've never gotten back on our feet after that. We've used a lot of the capacity that existed not to get us through to a period of stability, but just get us through that first legislative session and try to make those decisions. Therein, I think, lies the opportunity for you. The goal is not to build a budget reserve, to have it available, to sit there and not touch it, but how to really build that capacity and use that to get you to a place of new stability. This isn't on the horizon right now. We're actually not looking at in the near term that our trends are improving. We certainly all expect that with the next forecast that the word will get worse, the news will get worse, the budget deficit will be bigger. So in no way are we looking at, you know, the clouds clearing, the sun coming out, and that, you know, happy days are on the horizon again. So I think to think strategically about the use of one-time money, your own processes, and how do you have that longer-term perspective in an environment that really is not conducive to a long-term perspective is really the challenge, because much of what you've seen here really is not news to you, but it's the implementation of these recommendations where the real work needs to begin and where a group like this really can add value in thinking about process reform, even if it is only on the legislative side of the table, not across the multiple branches of government. The other observation I would share with you is the power of this body or of the governor's office to bring creative ideas to the table, because as you well know, sometimes the best ideas don't germinate in a legislative session within the halls of this building. So as you think about that challenge about not only getting through this biennium, but setting yourself up for good decision-making for the following biennium relative to the state budget, time's a wasting. And I would encourage you to think about where there can be a legislative commission or something in concert with the executive branch to talk about how are we meaningfully going to reform health care so that we can achieve the goal of improving health outcomes with great value attached to the spending instead of always being in a situation where it's January, you know, we have a deficit and so we have to reduce spending through eligibility or benefit changes. If there were meaningful reform opportunities, now is the time to get cracking on that before you're sitting here again 2 years from now talking about how you're going to adopt a budget for the upcoming biennium, facing a big deficit because of the use of one-time money. So I think that there is a lack of recognition sometimes here about how powerful you can be in convening people from across different sectors to help you develop ideas that actually lend themselves to better decision-making in this group. And even though the application of that may not yield great benefit this legislative session, you can't wait to get that in motion, and I would strongly encourage you to do that because there are people out there that want to help, that have a perspective that adds value, and you can be a convener of great import. And then finally, I would just say, you know, this is hard work. You know that. You've made great progress on many of these issues, and it's always easier to do that. During the 4 years that I served under a previous governor, the first part of that was still during an economic expansion. The last part wasn't. It was a lot easier to make progress on those goals when the economy was expanding. And think about what you can put in place now that might have an effect at some future point in time when the economic situation is different. So even if you can't bring yourself to resolve all of these budget challenges in a way that feels perfectly consistent with the bullet points on this page, there may be some things that you can do today that will have benefit as the situation improves in the future. And with that, I wish you the best of luck.
And glad that you're not sitting in Commissioner Hansen's seat earlier today. Senator Bergman, maybe you need to dust off those health care reforms again, and we need to take another try at all those things. Senator Berglin.
Madam Speaker, I mean, I think that would be a good idea, except that when we did them last year, we got no savings. Department of Human Services refused to book any savings, even though the Department of Health said if we did all these things, we would get a 10% reduction in health care spending, some of which would have to accrue to the state budget. So, you know, I think the whole system is set up not to reform. You know, governor's budget this year eliminates physical therapy for people who have strokes on Medicaid. How many of you think those people are going to be in nursing homes if they don't get physical therapy immediately following a stroke? I mean, there's no way built into the state budgeting process to account for the cost of unintended consequences or to hold spending decisions accountable for causing increases in spending. You know, you take physical therapy out of the budget, you save this many thousands of dollars, and nobody ever figures that there'll be any increase in nursing home placements as a result of it. I just find the whole thing totally frustrating because I don't think it's a very honest way of budgeting.
And Senator Berglin, I think that's and it's not going to arrive in time for right now, but you know, that's one of my interests in looking at things more systematically with a system dynamics approach to using data to see what questions drive decision making. Because frankly, we're all human and our brains are not nearly we're smart and we're probably the smartest thing walking on the face of the earth, but to handle the complexity as a group, as humans. But as a group, it's also hard to process that data. And, you know, there's systems that aren't designed and maybe designed to fail. The idea of cost savings, you know, how does that get accounted for in our system? It's a very good point. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and Commissioners, thanks for your work. Since you released your report on January 12th, there are at least two events that seem to bear on your analysis. I'd like your comment, to the extent you care to, on both. One is obviously the governor's budget recommendation. The second, though, is the Mike Vekich group that came out with some tax reform proposals that the governor put together. So I'm asking specifically if you care to comment on a couple of things. First, as to the governor's budget, and Commissioner Gunyer, you already have, but I'd like to hear, for the others of you who care to comment, on the tobacco appropriation bond proposal from the standpoint of sound budgeting. And second, I was wondering as to the Vekich general proposal, which has been around for a long time, of course, to broaden the sales tax. From a budgetary standpoint, do you have any comment on either or both of those?
Anyone? Well, I saw Mr. Krajowski get very excited and move to the front of his chair, so you get to go first.
Mr. Speaker, Representative Simon, I've been at this now for 25 years, actually 35 years if you include the time I worked at the Senate and also in the Minneapolis Budget Office and then at the state.
The secret Senate background.
Yes.
We use that in the House as well. The Speaker served as Senate staff as well. So,
I don't think I've seen a worse proposal from a governor than the proposal on the tobacco bonds. What it's in essence saying is we should try to solve our problem today by borrowing money from the future.
He doesn't like it much.
I've suggested in the past that what we're doing with the federal deficit is an error. My generation, the baby boomers, are in essence have forced our kids to pay for what we've spent now. And what the governor's doing with that tobacco bonds is doing the exact same thing, asking our kids to pay for our spending today. It's a terrible idea, and I'm hopeful that the legislature will flat out reject it. On the second one, you asked about extending the sales tax base from the tax commission or the tax group that the governor appointed. First of all, that wasn't bipartisan. It was the governor's appointments. We actually dealt with that, and we had a lot of debate about that. And interestingly, what the evidence showed was that extending the sales tax base, particularly to clothing and personal services, does not necessarily reduce the volatility of our total tax system. Going into the commission's deliberations, I thought it would. In fact, we were kibitzing in our first meeting, and numbers of us thought that that would be a recommendation that would come out of the commission. But it didn't, because it really, as we looked at it and had Tom Stinson and his staff do some analysis, they found that you could not conclude that it would reduce volatility to any great extent. So the choice you have is simply, do you want to extend the tax to add more items and either lower the rate or keep the rate the same, but we don't think it's going to change volatility appreciably.
Anyone else want to comment on either? And some may not choose to comment. So, Mr. Gunyer?
Madam Speaker, I was as surprised as Jay was, I think, with the data that we reviewed. I still think there are sound reasons, though, policy reasons, to restructure the sales tax base. The basic reason that it didn't make a big difference in volatility is we have such a broad tax system. I mean, it's one piece of the total tax system, so unless there were a major restructuring of all that, it wouldn't make that big a difference. I'm going to quote the speaker that I heard driving over today on NPR. You can never go wrong quoting the chair of a committee, but I think the change in our economy is reason to consider that change. As we've shifted from a goods to a service economy, I think there is a valid policy reason to tie that tax base more closely to the services that are being provided that are a bigger part of the economic base of the state.
Prompted by, of course, a caller into the radio program as well. So
that was not me. I didn't.
No, it was not you. It was Dan, I believe. Commissioner Wheelock, if I could ask you a follow-up to Representative Simon's question, Governor Ventura actually proposed a broadening of sales tax. And so do you have
twice.
twice. And do you have some observations for us about that?
You know, I think I would make two comments, well, maybe three. I don't think anyone at the table would disagree that the idea of bonding tobacco proceeds might not only be a bad policy idea, but might be difficult to even sell them in the marketplace. So I just want to move past that fairly quickly. Secondly, I would say the budget is made up of tax and spending. And to just take one tool off the table and say that you're not going to use that makes the process very difficult to try to find a fair outcome with a measured response to the economic circumstances. Specifically on the composition of the tax base, I really think that the challenge is, you know, one of equity, fairness, effectiveness, efficiency. The governor of Ventura twice in two legislative sessions tried to advance the notion of broadening it to the services, really in recognition of the way that people are spending their money, particularly as people age. You know, more often than not, people already have a washer and dryer. They already have, you know, 1, 2, 3 cars, 1, 2, 3 TVs. You know, once you start to get into that baby boom demographic and that aging population, the reality that you're going to be driving that consumer spending in the way that you would if they were younger is different. And as people's disposable income starts to move more to gravitating towards spending on services, there was a significant portion of the taxable base that was not being treated as a taxable base. And so the consideration was, is there a way to look at that service economy and think about expanding the base to capture some of the spending there? But you're going to want to be very careful about understanding the incidence of that and thinking about how you structure that, because that will fall on different income levels and different populations very differently. But I would really encourage you to think about doing something like that kind of analysis of the structure of the sales tax or the income tax for that matter, because deciding how much you want to raise in revenue is a big political issue, but it's not the only one. How you actually collect that and from whom is a very complicated discussion that generally falls on just the tax committee, but expanding the sales tax to services would be one strategy to look at.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Speaker, in looking at your commission recommendations, I'm intrigued with number 12 and number 2 combined. Number 12 says that spending should be on a trend line growth instead of the actual income that's coming in. And sometimes that trend line growth is, as we know right now, maybe negative. But over the long period of time, I think we can establish a trend line growth. But did you consider also the trend line growth with number 2, the demographics of that in your recommendation, and also the trend line growth of spending obligations as it relates to those demographics to local units of government and other units of government?
Anyone want to, Mr. Krajewski?
Madam Speaker, Representative Solberg, we did, and the state economist in doing the state forecast does include demographics for the next couple of years. They do make adjustments to what the models would suggest because they know the population is changing. So they don't simply take history, but they then use factors like demographic changes or maybe a federal law change or something else that's happening, and they adjust the forecast accordingly. So that is being included today in the forecast in a reasonable way. What we did was we went out 25 years, not 2 years. And clearly, when you go out that far, there are huge demographic trends that are going to be impacting Minnesota. And that was part of the finding of the commission, was that Minnesota's not going to grow its way out of this budget dilemma you face. We might have in the past, but we're not now because the demographics is working against us. It's going to be more costly in the future for state government, not less costly. And the best example of that is that by 2033, there'll be more people not working than working. That's going to be a very difficult period for that legislature to deal with.
You know, Ms. Representative Solberg, yes, well, but hold on a second. Okay, you know, okay. This table is actually quite representative of it, because I think Representative Simon and I are going to be working in 2033 for sure. So cool. Maybe not necessarily here, but working. So,
Madam Speaker,
there's a solver.
Looking at the
just demographics, looking just the numbers, everyone.
Yeah. Looking at any kind of an income that you may have from an investment, I'll be working in that length of time.
Yeah, that's
too.
Right, true too.
But I know that the Council of Economic Advisors and our model does take in demographics, but one of the things that was kind of interesting was one of the council members said that as they look at the demographics, he never envisioned the factor of immigration into our society. Mm-hmm. And so when you take the 12 with 2, and we can have those trends, but there are some trends out there that are also having a reverse effect, because the jobs may be here. We may require the jobs, but it just won't be the same type of people working. And I thought it was a very interesting statement that he made, that he never thought there would be a need for housing in the past because of our demographics, and never factored in immigration.
It's an interesting point that if you had a longer-term forecast on the demographic possibilities, that you may look at some other factors in this. Did the commission, that's kind of what you're getting at here, isn't it?
Exactly.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I had actually two questions, and one you touched on, which was the revenue bonds. Get your reaction to that.
Can you turn your mic around there?
The other one, I was just backing up, one of my questions was on the revenue bonds, and you've covered that. But I did have a question, because I think I've worked with at least three of you when we use shifts as a part of the problem. And with the huge problem that we have now, that's quite frankly part of the discussion as well. And if one of you at least could comment briefly on your thoughts, having had experience that decision.
Yeah.
Because that's very much on the table right now. And when we're facing $5 billion, the governor said that's part of the solution, and we may have to look very seriously at that as well. And I know I've been here in the past when we did, but I'd be interested in your comments.
Ms. Ingerson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Carlson. I think that I did some testimony in front of the Education Committee in the House a couple of weeks ago to talk a little bit about the school funding shift in particular that was included as part of the governor's recommendations. And I guess I just want to say something at the outset, that I have a great deal of sympathy for anybody in the Department of Finance that is working to put together budget recommendations in this situation. It's among the most difficult that we've seen in years. So not to be critical of this, but I just want people to understand, get the a little historical perspective about the shift, because in reality, this isn't just a painless, easy way to quickly balance the budget. It's another thing that indicates to everybody else that we don't have enough discipline in our process to really make tough decisions. And whether it's, the borrowing kinds of things like the tobacco bonds or the shift, I think that they have been used as tools in the past, but I think it's really important for us to keep that in context and to recognize that, as everybody is saying around the halls in this building and the building across the street, that, it's just really something that, human services is being cut so dramatically and education gets an increase. And I think that it's all in the perspective that we take, and it's really going to be important for people to recognize that, actual spending from one year to the next, as opposed to what we contrive as our starting point or reference point. And in fact, there are implications for school districts when there's a shift, and there are impacts in the classroom. And I think we, for the first time in a number of years, are starting to see enrollment increase at the same time that we see the pretty dramatic shift, or what I would still call a cut in education funding.
Representative Carlson, follow.
Chair, just a follow-up. I had an opportunity. I think Representative Simon may have been at the same meeting. We met with a group of superintendents from some of the western suburbs probably a month or two ago, and we discussed the shifts. And the ones that commented and the others seemed to support them, they seemed to think a shift was manageable. But the issue that they put on the table was how rapidly you bought down the shift, that they viewed that as problematic because it did, and of course, that's 40% of the state budget, so they viewed that as problematic in terms of gaining future revenues when we had that fast buyback. And I don't know if one of you would care to comment on that, maybe.
Ms. Ingus.
Being that you work for a school district currently,
right,
maybe
right.
Have some thoughts on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I think that the poor choice that's frequently put to people, and I've talked to some of my colleagues in other school districts, is wouldn't you rather have a shift than a cut? And I think it's really all about, you know, being straightforward. And in one of the things that I've discovered is there's nothing very straightforward at all about education funding, because we often talk about here's how much money we're giving, and we create all this expectation that there's new money, and in fact it's really not there, it's prorated or something else. And so it's part of being realistic about what we're doing. And if we're really talking about cutting education, I don't think, you know, I think it would be one thing to say a shift and that doesn't really count, but, you know, we wouldn't be talking about comparing a cut of $1.3 billion in education and the consequences that has with shifting $1.3 billion in education. So I think that there are implications for the long term. Less dollars available for the reform that people are talking about to reform education, buying back the shift would take a priority in any future revenue increases, I would think.
Mr. Gagneau?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, I was thinking back in, I was going to say my day, but it was our day, because I think we did it at the same time. It was, the shift was part of the solution back in the first Carlson term. But the out-biennium was balanced, or as it was used as a one-time measure, but then it was balanced in the next biennium. And I think that's I view the shift as a valid tool. How much, the depth, the payback, and all that is a question, but it gets back to this issue of how do you use those one-time resources to buy time to make sure things are in place so that you're not just prolonging the problem.
Carlson, did you?
Oh, that's fine. Thank
okay.
you.
And just on that.
Yeah, Senator Pogomello.
And this, the next part of that during the Carlson years, that was the years I was K-12 chair. Senator Olson, you and I spent serious money in the later years of the Carlson years buying back that shift. Not putting it into education, but buying back the shift. Almost the entire 8 years I was chair, that's what we did.
Sarah Olson.
And Madam Chair, it was kind of interesting to me at a recent meeting that of superintendents, that one of our superintendents in the western suburban area suggested that if you shift, leave it. Don't keep buying it back. Because that is actually almost more dishonest.
Former Commissioner Ingerson just passed out.
That was a superintendent talking. I have never heard that comment before.
We're getting those superintendents about fiscal management.
Yeah, then it's a cut.
Former commissioners, I'm going to let you have the last word, but I do have a question for you. Has the commission been able to brief the governor in person? The governor did appoint a third of the members to the commission. The co-chair was a former Republican legislator. Do you know if the governor has been briefed in person?
Madam Speaker, my co-chair, Kevin Goodnow, and I met with Commissioner Hansen in, I think it was October or early November, as it became clear what the likely recommendations of the commission were going to be. And the purpose of our meeting was, frankly, to understand whether Commissioner Hansen would be supportive, because, frankly, he had not participated in the meetings. Jim Showalter, the budget director, was our key staff person, along with Tom Stinson and his staff. So we thought it was prudent to find out if Tom would first support it. And then we asked him, because he did express support for these recommendations. He actually, at that point, we were still talking about the sales tax, and he said he thought the governor would object to the sales tax, and ultimately it didn't end up in the report for a lot of other reasons. Mainly, we found out it didn't do much on volatility. We asked Tom if we should go to the governor, and he said that he would take care of making sure the governor understood what was in the report. And that was the last request we made.
Okay. So we'll make an assumption here, because sometimes assumptions are made around here, that the governor has not been briefed in person by anyone on the report. And maybe the governor's staff can correct that. I'm sure they're tuning in this afternoon to the hearing here. So I'm going to just make that wild assumption that the governor maybe has not been briefed in person on this.
Madam Speaker, just on that point, I think it's fair, though, to suggest that, that Commissioner Hansen, when working with the governor on building his budget, I'd bet a lot that Commissioner Hansen raised the issue about the out-biennium deficit.
I'm sure he did. And
most commissioners of finance, if not all, would see that as a problem and would want, and I'm not speaking for the commissioner, you can ask him yourself, but it's in the nature of the job to at least point out the problem. Because you asked us to speak to the question about what did our governors think way back when. Well, Governor Perpich yelled at me, "I don't want any more damn deficits." He said, "I didn't get elected to be governor to have to cut everything. Fix this," was the order we got. And that's when we built the budget reserve. That's when we built the trigger tax. That's when we looked at the out biennium so that we wouldn't get into that situation. Mm-hmm. Any good commissioner of finance would advise the governor of that potential problem 2 years from now.
And I think that we can say that we would assume the professionalism continues in the office of Commissioner of Finance. It may seem like to all of you that you've said these things before to people, and it was interesting reading the report that many of these things that are recommended have been recommended over and over again. But in the spirit of you must hear things many, many times before you learn them, that is why you are here today. And
from multiple people.
And from multiple people with very different backgrounds and experiences and serving for very, very different individuals. So maybe I'll let you each have the last word, and maybe if we could start with Ms. Wheelock, if there's anything else that you want to say to us today. Senator Pogamiller.
Well, we've kind of gotten inside the doors up there about what Perpich once said and about what you guys said about Governor Carlson. I'd like to know what you all said about your governors, or they said about
or about the budget. Well, I don't know.
You know, I think it's kind of an interesting way to end this, you know, for us to talk about our relationship with our former bosses, so why not? But I would say one of the things that was that I most respected about Governor Ventura is his concern about fiscal responsibility. And he really believed, you could argue with him about the specifics of every budget and every budget decision he made. In fact, I think you override his veto on a couple of budget bills in that last session. But he really believed that it was not responsible to try to enact policies today that you couldn't pay for tomorrow, and to try to shift the cost for the benefits you were getting today to taxpayers tomorrow. And whether you like the idea early in his term or not about sending back the rebate checks to Minnesotans, it was a one-time issue. It wasn't permanent tax relief. It wasn't an increase in permanent spending. And he took that very seriously. And whether it was during economic expansion or even as the economy contracted, it was, in my opinion, one of the most remarkable qualities that he held and that he evidenced during the 4 years he was governor.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Final words.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, I just really want to say that I appreciate the chance to have worked on the commission with really a lot of good folks with good ideas, and there's a lot that I learned in spite of the fact that some of the findings, again, as I mentioned, you know, aren't necessarily news to us. I think it's helpful to have things put together in the report the way they are here. I hope that it's helpful that we spend some time looking at past reports to make sure that we were incorporating the best of the things that had been said before. So I really wish you well, because I think there's a tremendous challenge here.
Thank you. Mr. Gunn, do you have anything else for us?
I was just going to tell one story about Governor Carlson. It's when he hired me, and he reminded me this throughout the, 6 years eventually that I worked for him. He always said, "You worry about the finances, John, and I'll worry about the politics." And I always respected him for that. He had a financial background, so it was easy to talk with him about that. But I always felt that we had the latitude to propose what was right to him, and he always listened. And I always felt that we had a good relationship with your staffs. We didn't have disagreements over the numbers, and we didn't have disagreements about there's a normal background of politics, obviously, in everything. But I think fundamentally we're all committed to sound financial management, and there were different pieces the way that could be put together. And I'd encourage you to think that way. And I think this report gives you a good basis for that. Not everything can be done this year, but certainly some of the things we talked about, I would hope you take to heart as you make some of your decisions.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you. And thank you to the members. We will be back together again next week. And what we're going to do is focus on the Federal Recovery and Reinvestment Act again, in both Shovel Ready, the area of grants, and the area of transparency and accountability. So thank you, members. We're adjourned.
Good job.